welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 31st of May 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. We are at the end of the month of May, and we're at the beginning of the week, and that means we have Max Musson with us today to discuss the week's news. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing? It's beautiful, beautiful day over here. What's it like where you are?
Yeah, it's been a beautiful weekend altogether, actually, I think. I was just saying to somebody a bit earlier on today that this is perfect weather, really, that we're having at the moment, which is sunny but not too hot and dry. And I think everything's looking, from an environmental point of view, everything's looking rosy, isn't it?
It is, and it's a bank holiday weekend as well. It's a bank holiday Monday, so very nice to have good weather. But we've been a little bit light on the news. There really hasn't been that much happening over last week. There was this incident where Sasha Johnson got shot at a party, and I spoke about that a little bit on the Daily Nationalist. And apparently there were four black youths, I think, burst in on this party and started firing their weapon, and she took a shot to the head and was hospitalized. And straight away we had Diane Abbott claiming that this was because of her activism, and we had the Taking the Initiative party, her party, they were saying that this was down to her activism. And then the police came out and they said, well, actually, no, there is nothing to suggest that this was anything to do with credible death threats. We are looking for a gang-related shooting, and there was a witness that said that this was a gang-related shooting. And then the police said, we're looking for four black suspects. And apparently they arrested these four black suspects, and there is an 18-year-old who has been charged with conspiracy to murder. And this I really question. Conspiracy to murder, I mean, that means that this was pre-planned. It means that it was worked out. And to me, that sounds like she was targeted. I mean, if it's a conspiracy to murder someone, then surely it means that there was a specific target. Sasha Johnson was specifically targeted, which means that it may not just be gang-related. I don't know. What do you make of the shooting of Sasha Johnson, Max?
Well, I would think that if it is a conspiracy to murder, then that would mean that she was being targeted by a criminal faction within the black community, in inverted commas, which would tend to suggest that the movement that she is a sort of leading member of, the Taking the Initiative party, that is in some way involved with black criminality. But if she wasn't, if it wasn't conspiracy to murder, if it was just a random shooting where somebody was going through to, but was just firing upon the party that she was attending in order to terrorize people for whatever reason, then that again suggests that she and the people that she mixes with are mixing with people who've got criminal links, etc. And it just makes it even an even more stupid thing to have happened, and more sort of catastrophic thing from her point of view to have happened, because having spent last summer attending various demonstrations in the centre of London, where she was disparaging the police and basically saying to people to take to the streets and fuck the police, and saying how saying that the police weren't were no different from the KKK, she's now in a situation where she is relying upon the actions of the police to save her from these shooters within the black community, which is kind of ironic, really.
Very ironic, very ironic. I guess, actually, the conspiracy to murder, I mean, there could have been a conspiracy to just shoot somebody at the party. Apparently, the shooters were not happy that there was a member of a rival gang that was at the party. So they may have conspired together to just take out somebody at the party as retribution. And it may have been her accidentally. So that could be the conspiracy to murder there. And a lot of people have been saying, well, this Sasha Johnson, she was no friend to whites. She was very anti-white, but she was standing up for her people. And if you're standing up for your people, then you're doing the right thing. I think she was doing the right thing by standing up for blacks. Okay, I may disagree with the way that some of the things that she was saying, blaming white people for black people's problems, I don't agree with that. But the fact that she was actually standing up for her people, trying to get them together on an ethnic basis, I think that is a good thing. And, you know, it's a shame that she has been shot, because she was quite a colourful character, and she really did highlight the differences that there are between whites and blacks. I don't think she's ever going to get to a situation where black people are ruling everything, and all these microaggressions will be written down on a record, and anybody guilty of microaggressions is sent to prison. I mean, she was quite extreme in these ideas that she had, but she was never actually going to get anywhere with them. And by promoting them, that helps white people to look at that and think, well, hang on a minute, something's gone seriously wrong here. I thought racism was about hating other people, not about just policing people's language and ostracizing them and jailing them for this sort of thing. So, you know, I'm not too critical of her. And she did speak to people on our side, ethno-nationalists. She wasn't one of these people that deplatformed, you know, the white nationalists. She spoke to Charlie Big Potatoes, a 10-minute long stream. So, you know, I don't think she was that bad. And there are quite a few people like Lawrence Fox that have said that they're concerned for her, and they hope that she is okay. And some people have pointed out, well, she's actually got her wish now, hasn't she? She will need to have white servants attending to her after being shot in the head. I mean, you can come round from that, I guess. I mean, it could be she could be lucky, but unfortunately, you know, I think she might very well be limited to a wheelchair, and she might lose her mental faculties, which is a terrible thing to happen. It's a colourful personality that I think, you know, we will miss. We will miss being able to discuss these things and point out that these big differences that there are between the races. I mean, one of them is the level of crime that there is. And this just shows you that the level of crime that there is in the black community. I mean, if you go to a white garden party, you don't expect to get shot. And yet quite a lot of the time we hear about these parties that have lots of blacks there, and there's shootings or there's stabbings, all sorts of dreadful things that happen to them. And, you know, much as we would like to put a stop to it, it just seems that there is a much higher level of criminality among the black community. And that's the same wherever you go. It doesn't matter if it's a black country like Haiti or a black part of America like Baltimore or Detroit, or if it's in a multicultural center like London. There is a much higher level of criminality among them. And if you have white people that are living in that area, it puts the whites at risk as well. And obviously the sensible solution to that is to separate. You've got any other comments you'd like to make on this Sasha Johnson incident, Max?
Well, I think I tend to agree with what the inferences that you've drawn from it. I think from her point of view, she is a politician who has, in an uncompromising way, basically demonstrated the truth of Disraeli's statement that race is all. And I think that one of the naive fallacies that often cripples the minds really of white people is that their expectation that if they desist from any kind of race-based thought about the way in which the world is run or anything of that sort, that the black people they elect to positions of power in parliament, etc., will have as much concern for them as those black politicians have for their own people. And I think that what Sasha Johnson's demonstrated really in an uncompromising way is the fact that just as David Lammy and other such politicians tend to focus on the the effects that politics have on their own ethnic group. You know, from her point of view, she's kind of exaggerated that in calling for things that lots of people would regard as being almost ridiculous, but sort of demonstrating very clearly that as far as white people are concerned, when we elect black politicians and non-white politicians, we are naive if we think that they are going to have as much loyalty to the white community as they have to their own ethnic group. And the fact of the matter is that they will tend to have more loyalty to their own ethnic group as the sort of policies advocated by the Taking the Initiative Party tends to suggest, with, you know, things like campaigning for reparations for black people because of slavery, which ostensibly sounds, you know, almost logical. You might think to yourself, well, yeah, well, of course black people should have some sort of reparations because of slavery. But what you've got to think about is that as far as the economy of Britain is concerned, as far as the economy of the British Empire was concerned, having slaves within the British Empire actually was to the great disadvantage of the majority of white people, people who could have found employment, etc., at various places in the throughout the British Empire, would have found that their ability to find employment was limited by virtue of the fact that they were competing against slaves who weren't actually paid a salary, and so therefore it could be argued that white people suffered just as much from slavery as black people suffered from it, and then with the compensation for the landed gentry, for the slaves and things that they owned in tropical parts of the British Empire, a vast amount of money was spent compensating them for the loss of their slaves when we British initiated the abolition of slavery. And the British taxpayer, which is primarily the working people of Britain, have had to pay off that debt over a 100-year period. And so therefore we've suffered initially because we had we were unable to enjoy the employment that having an empire should have provided for our people. Secondly, we've then taken on an enormous debt, and it's taken us a century or more to pay off of that debt. And now people like Sacha Johnson are expecting us to then start paying massive amounts of reparations to black people. And the victim in all these three stages of this this argument are the white working people of Britain, and I think it's about time that we started standing up for ourselves and saying, sorry, enough is enough. We've had enough of being the fall guy for all of these things, and you know, we're looking after ourselves from now on. Thank you very much.
Well, that's the point, isn't it? We need to say, look, you've already had your reparations. You were paid in kind. It's not like these slaves weren't given anything. They were given a roof over their heads. They were given food. They were given warmth. They were given medical care. They were looked after, even when they were unable to work. They were given a creche, and in actual fact, it actually costs more to keep a slave than it costs to actually pay wages. I mean, that was the reason why it was given up. But you can't expect blacks not to advocate for that, because it's going to be to their benefit, isn't it? The more they push for reparations, the more likely it is that they're going to get some form of reparations. They have in America, some parts of America have paid out for housing, they're paying out now for farmland for them. So it's to their benefit to do that. We can't criticize them for pushing for that. That's one of their strategies. That's how blacks work to increase their prosperity. They push to get more reparations from whites. They push to claim that they're not being treated equally, and they need to have benefits that whites don't have. They push for diversity quotas. All these things benefit them, and we can't criticize them for doing so. What we can criticize is whites for not seeing that what this is all about is actually taking from whites to give to them. And we need to be standing up for our own interests, in the same way that we see David Lammy and Diane Abbott showing solidarity with George Floyd, a criminal from America. Because George Floyd was black, that's why they stand up for him. And we need to show solidarity with whites that we see from around the world, rather than standing up for blacks around the world and saying that we should be standing up for them because somehow we've been mean to them. Because if we don't stand up for our own interests, nobody else is going to do that for us. And it's just the way that it is. It's if you're an individual, nobody else is going to provide you with a roof over your head. You have to go out there and work to provide for your own family. Nobody else is going to do that. If you're going out there and just doing everything for other people's families, your own family is being neglected. And that's the way that it is at the moment. We are neglecting our own family. And we have to look at it in that way. Your race, your nation, it's your extended family. It's your extended kinship group. And that is what a nation should be based around. And when you look at it like that, because I was watching a debate yesterday with Mark Collette against civic nationalists, and the civic nationalists were saying, oh, yes, but there's good eggs and there's bad eggs. And what we need to do is separate the good guys from the bad guys. And then we'll just have all the good immigrants and that will be fine. Well, it doesn't matter if they're good or they're bad. Each one of them is replacing one of you. It comes down to ethnicity. Even if they are all good, if they're making up 20% of the country, that's 20% of the country that now belongs to them instead of belonging to us. So this idea that there's good ones and there's bad ones, they are fundamentally different to us. If there's too many of them and we become a minority, then the chances are that you know, we're just going to go extinct as a species. And the reason for that will be, or extinct as a subspecies rather, and the reason for that will be because we stopped looking out for our own interests and devoted all our time to looking out for these other people's interests. That's where the fault lies. We cannot say that the fault lies with blacks for the way they're behaving, or the fault lies with Jews for the way they're behaving, because they are doing what is best for their people. The fault lies squarely with us for not doing what is best for us, I think.
Absolutely.
You were saying that you were watching something on Netflix, I believe, while you were looking into this Sacha Johnson stuff, Max.
Yes, I just flicked through a few things on Netflix and let this one program run. It had a kind of like an interesting title to the program. It was called "And Tomorrow, the Entire World," and in German, because the film was originally in German, it was then dubbed into English. Was "And Morgen die ganze Welt," and this is a film which was produced in 2020 by a producer called Julia von Heinz, and she was a one-time Antifa activist, I believe. And the theme of the film revolves around Article 20, Section 4 of the German Constitution, which is that the Federal Republic of Germany is a democratic and social state. All Germans have the right to resist anyone who seeks to abolish this constitutional order if no other remedy is available. And the film is basically around a character called Louisa who goes off to college and then teams up with a friend called Bata. They live in a squat with a load of other members of an Antifa group. This Antifa group are concerned about the rise of a fictional nationalist group called List 14, which is supposed to be kind of analogous to Alternative for Deutschland. The group is led then by two men, one called Alpha and the other one called Lenore. So this Antifa group are sort of there's a bit of a schism within the group where one section wants to protest and take action against the rise of this List 14 organization using largely peaceful means, but not entirely peaceful means. They're prepared to use violence, but they don't want to use violence that inflicts permanent damage or death upon the List 14 people, whereas the other group, which is led by Louisa and Alpha, are quite happy to use more extreme forms of violence. And the thing that caught my eye with regard to this program was that it presents Antifa in a far more honest and frank way than anything I've ever seen before. And it makes it quite obvious that as far as the violence that exists between Antifa and German nationalist organizations stems primarily from the Antifa groups. And what this film portrayed was the Antifa groups finding out where the The nationalists were going to hold their meetings, finding out whether they were going to park their cars prior to the meeting, and then during the meeting going along and then vandalizing the cars, smashing their windscreens, kicking their side wing mirrors off, smashing the glass windows with hammers, and basically hammering and denting and jumping all over the cars to make them a bit of a mess by the time the list 14 people got back. And then on one occasion, as the list 14 people were arriving back in the darkness of night, these Antifa people, all clad in black rather, with hammers and crowbars and other weapons, then attacked them and gave them a thorough beating. And this just very clearly demonstrated Antifa's modus operandi. And so it just sort of, if you just watch the film, it then makes you question why are these people allowed to do this, and yet they've not been categorized as a terrorist organization, because the film ends with this girl Louisa stealing a rifle from her parents' home, deciding not to use the rifle, but eventually just using explosives to destroy the headquarters, the local sort of branch office of this organization, List 14. Here we have somebody who, by all accounts, if you believe what it says in on the internet, Julia von Heinz, a one-time Antifa activist, and it basically says, if you read reviews of this, that to some extent this is biographical from Julia Heinz's point of view. So what we have here is somebody making a film which they believe is absolutely true, demonstrating the activities of the kind of people that they used to hang around with, showing quite clearly that that these people have criminal intent and in some cases murderous intent. And so, as I say, it's surprising really that nobody has bothered so far to designate Antifa as a criminal organization, well, as a terrorist organization, I should say.
Well, this idea that violence can be used to against people simply for having a different opinion, I mean, it really does seem to be growing. So maybe the fact that you saw that and you thought, well, this is really wrong, this is showing something that's really wrong, maybe there'll be a certain percentage of the population that see that and think, well, yeah, we need more of these people that use violence. I mean, last week there was an incident with a young homeless girl. And she was very small, very, very petite homeless girl. And she was outside one of the London railway stations. And a professional black footballer turned up, and he's filming it on his camera. And he's saying, "What did you say? What did you say? What did you call me?" Needling this girl. And then she uses a racial slur, and he boots over her cup, which she'd put out there for money. And then he returns with a drink, and he pours the drink all over this girl. And then he proudly posted this, and he said words to the effect of, "She was lucky I didn't see her last year, or I would have really gone for her." It's sort of implying that he would have got really violent with her if she'd said this word last year. And the really sad thing about this was that there were a lot of people saying, "Well, oh, yes, you did really well there. I mean, it's totally unacceptable to use racial slurs." But it's just a word. I mean, this poor girl is homeless. She's half his size. Where is this idea that men shouldn't hit women gone? How come that has now disappeared? How come it's now acceptable to use physical violence just because you don't like what somebody else is saying? And this is the way that things seem to be going. The more they equate racial slurs or incitement to hate, the more they equate that with violence, the more people are going to feel as if they are entitled to use actual violence against somebody that they think is inciting hate or using racial slurs. And the way that they're trying to push things now with the law, with this hateful extremism thing, and they're trying to say that even if people don't even have an intent to incite hate, we can still prosecute them for incitement to hate, and then that's against the law. And if you see somebody breaking the law, you're supposed to try and prevent them. So it's effectively saying, giving them the green light to use physical violence against anybody who says something that they don't like, anybody who has a different opinion to them. So, you know, taking it back to this film, maybe that's, you know, that's justifying that. I would be worried that there would be a group of people in society that were on the side of you know, making more violence on the left and encouraging them to carry out more violence against people that are on the right. Did you catch this video at all, Max, last week?
No, I don't think I didn't see that video, but it's I agree 100% with what you said about it, that people are just being encouraged to be so thin-skinned and to be offended by what other people say, and to regard the offence that they feel as justification for them using violence against the person who's offended them. You know, where has the sticks and stones may break my bones approach to this? Where has that gone? That was the traditional British way of dealing with these kind of issues in the past. You know, somebody can insult you, but that doesn't give you the right to then unleash violence upon them for doing that. And in the same way, somebody can campaign for a political end as far as the country is concerned, a political goal. And because their political goal differs from yours, that doesn't give you the right to use violence against that person. And it's just it's quite sad, I think, that there are still people around who relish in violence and try to deny other people their civil rights.
When we used to be a very tolerant society, we used to be brought up to be tolerant and tolerant of people's views. Not everybody is going to have the same view that you have. And the whole idea of being British, we were told we had lots of British eccentrics, and we had the monster raving loony party and all these different political ideas and strands and people with different ways of doing things, and we're all tolerant of one another. And that's now changed, and we're told, oh no, you shouldn't be tolerant of people that think differently to you. If you think differently to the mainstream narrative, then you're a hater, or at worst you could be a terrorist, and one of these non-violent non-extremist terrorists. I mean, once you classify somebody having a different opinion as terrorism, then people feel justified in using violence to prevent others from expressing their opinion. It goes right against, you know, fundamental British values of tolerance for people having different opinions and different points of view. It's a really bad direction that we're heading in if we tolerate that sort of thing, and we tolerate violence against people simply for using words. But that is what is being pushed by the media, and that is what is being implied by the people that want to change our laws to make it so that there's no need to even provide proof of intent to incite hatred anymore, particularly this law that's coming in Scotland. Well, I don't know if you want to add anything to that, Max, or shall we move on to our Greatest Britons?
Let's move on to the Greatest Britons, yes.
Okay, let's get into our Greatest Britons for the week, which is Rudyard Kipling, and this is part four, and we will probably finish the series today. We'll start with a recap. Last episode, we talked about Rudyard Kipling's holidays in South Africa, where he was received warmly by Cecil Rhodes as the poet of the empire. Back home in Britain, he was living in rural Devon, where he found time to write the poem If, which we quoted, and which helped cement his status as winner of the Nobel Prize for Literature. He was against home rule for Ireland, seeing it as a weakening of the Union, and not being of any benefit to the Irish, as he thought it would plunge the country into a new dark age. He was a big supporter of the Ulster Unionists, and considered it an act of treason by the then Prime Minister, Herbert Asquith. He was against Bolshevism and created the Liberty League with Rider Haggard as a form of resistance to the rise of communism within Britain. Is there anything you'd like to add to that recap, Max?
No, that seems to be fairly sort of thorough.
Well, we'll move on to the war years next. At the beginning of the First World War, like many other writers, Kipling wrote pamphlets and poems enthusiastically supporting the UK war aims of restoring Belgium after it had been occupied by Germany, together with generalised statements that Britain was standing up for the cause of good in the world. In September 1914, he was asked by the government to write propaganda, an offer that he accepted. His pamphlets and his stories were popular with the British people during the war, with his major themes being to glorify the British military as the place for heroic men to be, while at the same time citing German atrocities against Belgian civilians, and the stories of women brutalized by a horrific war unleashed by Germany, yet surviving and triumphing in spite of their suffering. Kipling was enraged by reports of the rape of Belgium, together with the sinking of the RMS Lusitania in 1915, which he saw as a deeply inhumane act, which led him to see the war as a crusade for civilization against barbarism. In a 1915 speech, Kipling declared, "There was no crime, no cruelty, no abomination that the mind of men can conceive of, which the German has not perpetrated, is not perpetrating, and will not perpetrate if he is allowed to go on. Today there are only two divisions in the world, human beings and Germans." And this is interesting because both of these instances that they cite here, the rape of Belgium and the sinking of the Lusitania, both did not happen in the way that we are told. The rape of Belgium was a propaganda exercise. That didn't happen, that it's been investigated and the reports have been found to be false. It was black propaganda. And the Lusitania, that was a setup by Winston Churchill. He had started putting weapons on civilian ships, and he had also said that with the U-boats, they weren't supposed to allow them to disembark into the lifeboats anymore. So when the U-boats saw these ships, these supposedly civilian ships, that they knew that they were carrying weapons on there. And the Lusitania was all stocked up with weapons and ammunition. So when the U-boat hit it, it blew up, basically. It was a setup. Winston Churchill had done that as a setup to try and bring America into the war. And Kipling fell for this, and he fell for these reports, and he helped to propagandize them himself. And what this really shows is that even the best of us can fall for this propaganda. A lot of us today will say, well, you know, all these boomers messed everything up, and why did they go to war against the Germans? We would never do anything like that. But yet this shows us that somebody that was as patriotic and as intelligent as Kipling could have the wool pulled over his eyes by the people that wanted war, and he fell for that. And if somebody like Kipling can fall for that, then any of us can. I don't think any of us are any better than our ancestors, and we don't have the right to condemn them as if we wouldn't have done the same if we were in that same situation. What are your thoughts on this, Max? The rape of Belgium and the Lusitania and the rest of it.
Yeah, I think conclusions that you've drawn from this are well founded. I think that Kipling lived, as some of us are still living, really on the cusp between an era where there was a high degree of truth and integrity in terms of the reporting of political events, where there's a transition to a time when there is a very loose link with the truth when it comes to reporting political events, and I think that he had obviously grown up becoming accustomed to being able to trust the reports that he'd received, and was sorely misled with regard to the reports on these two incidents.
Yeah, he trusted the British government. I mean, the faking of the media really began in General Gordon's time. I suppose that was about 50 or 60 years previous. That was the first instance of it. And then in this First World War, Britain became known for this black propaganda and admitted it. By the time of the Second World War, we had admitted that a lot of this was fake. But Kipling fell for it. He believed in Britain. He believed that the government were good and they wouldn't lie to him. Alongside his passionate antipathy towards Germany, Kipling was privately deeply critical of how the war was being fought by the British Army, complaining as early as October 1914 that Germany should have been defeated by now, and something must be wrong with the British Army. K- Kipling, who was shocked by the heavy losses that the British Expeditionary Force had taken by the autumn of 1914, blamed the entire pre-war generation of British politicians, who he argued had failed to learn the lessons of the Boer War. Thus, thousands of British soldiers were now paying with their lives for their failure in the fields of France and Belgium. Kipling had scorn for men who shirked duty in the First World War, and in a piece called The New Army in Training in 1915, he concluded it by saying, "This much we can realise, even though we are so close to it. The old safe instinct saves us from triumph and exultation. But what will be the position in years to come of the young man who has deliberately elected to outcast himself from this all-embracing brotherhood? What of his family? And above all, what of his descendants, when the books have been closed and the last balance struck of sacrifice and sorrow in every hamlet, village, parish, suburb, city, shire, district, province, and dominion throughout the empire?" In 1914, Kipling was one of 53 leading British authors, a number that included H.G. Wells, Arthur Conan Doyle, and Thomas Hardy, who signed their names to the Authors' Declaration. This manifesto declared that the German invasion of Belgium had been a brutal crime and that Britain could not, without dishonour, have refused to take part in the present war. So he thought that the British weren't being extreme enough and that they should have won this war by now. Because I think there was an instance where nobody was really advancing, and it got to the point where Germany had almost won the war, and then I think America came in on the side of Britain, and the sinking of the Lusitania was something to do with that. Max, maybe you know more about this time than me. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I can't confirm the sort of the timings of the sinking of the Lusitania, although I do believe it came prior to the Americans' entry into the First World War, and probably was one of the factors that influenced their entry into the war. I think the early part of the 20th century was a tipping point in many respects, and it was a tipping point in terms of military strategy and military tactics on the battlefield as well. And one of the things that the British Army had prided itself on prior to the First World War was blind obedience, and blind obedience was taught to the other ranks, such that they would blindly follow the orders that they had, even though the orders quite obviously meant that they would be, in certain cases, marching to their deaths. And the reason why they might, in certain cases, be marching to their deaths would be because between the point in time where the commanding officer had decided the order of battle, and when the battle commenced, or when the soldiers engaged the enemy, there would have been a change of in the situations where the enemy perhaps would have moved to different positions, where the enemy strength may have changed, etc. And with blind obedience, soldiers were not able to deviate from the orders that they were given, and if they did deviate, then they were blamed for any losses that occurred and severely punished. And the but the point is that quite often, and it's a well-known saying now, that the first casualty of war is the I think that's used with regard to the truth. First casualty of war is the truth, but also the first casualty of war is the battle plan. A battle plan doesn't survive contact with the enemy, I think is the phrase, is the saying that I was struggling to find then. And the point is that very often when junior officers lead their men into battle, they find that the situation that they're in is markedly different from that their commanding officers were aware of. And that they can either then complete their orders blindly and end up being killed in large numbers, or they can deviate from the orders that they've given and have some chance of survival. And so there was a change from what's called blind obedience to intelligent obedience. And intelligent obedience is where the junior officers, when they find themselves in a situation where the situation has changed out of all recognition from the situation that existed when the commanding officer made devised the orders, that where that junior officer can deviate, as long as the aim that the junior officer has is the same as the overall aim of the commanding officer. And this is something that I think the German side learned earlier than the British Army did. And it was because of that that German soldiers fared so well during the early part of the Second World War, where they had thoroughly learned the principle of intelligent obedience, whereas it was something that was still very new and was only just being implemented as far as the British Army was concerned.
I think also the British had been used to winning all these battles because a lot of them had taken place with natives in India or natives in Africa, and our superior firepower had meant that we didn't suffer that many losses. So we were used to winning battles, and I think we can also see the social pressure that there was on people to go and fight for your country. I mean, if you didn't go and fight, then you were going to be completely ostracized. I mean, like he says here, you know, how can anybody live with the shame? They're going to feel that wherever they are, in the village, the parish, the suburb, the city. You know, how is the person's family going to manage to deal with the shame if they didn't go out and fight? And I think he really ended up regretting that, as we'll see in this next bit. His son John was killed in action at the Battle of Loos in September 1915 at only 18 years of age. John initially wanted to join the Royal Navy, but having had his application turned down after a failed medical examination due to poor eyesight, he opted to apply for military service as an army officer. Again, his eyesight was an issue during the medical examination. In fact, he tried twice to enlist, but was rejected. His father, however, had been lifelong friends with Lord Roberts, the former Commander-in-Chief of the British Army and Colonel of the Irish Guards, and at Rudyard's own request, John was accepted into the Irish Guards. John Kipling was sent to Loos 2 days into the battle as part of a reinforcement contingent. He was last seen stumbling through the mud blindly with a possible facial injury. A body identified as his was found in 1992, although that identification has been challenged. In 2015, the Commonwealth War Grave Commission confirmed that it had correctly identified the burial place of John Kipling, and they record his date of death as 27th of September 1915, and that he is buried at St. Mary's ADS Cemetery, Haynes. After his son's death, in a poem titled Epitaphs of the War, Kipling wrote, "If any question why we died, tell them because our fathers lied." Critics have speculated that these words may express Kipling's guilt over his role in arranging John's commission. Professor Tracy Bilsing contends that the line refers to Kipling's disgust that British leaders failed to learn the lessons of the Boer War and were unprepared for the struggle with Germany in 1914, with the lie of the fathers being that the British Army was prepared for any war when it was not. John's death has been linked to Kipling's 1916 poem, My Boy Jack. However, the poem was originally published at the head of a story about the Battle of Jutland and appears to refer to a death at sea. The Jack referred to may be to the boy VC Jack Cornwell, or perhaps a generic Jack Tar. In the Kipling family, Jack was the name of the family dog, while John Kipling was always John, making the identification of the protagonist of My Boy Jack with John Kipling somewhat questionable. However, Kipling was indeed emotionally devastated by the death of his son, and he is said to have helped assuage his grief by reading the novels of Jane Austen aloud to his wife and daughter. Kipling became friends with a French soldier named Maurice Hamanu, whose life had been saved in the First World War when his copy of the book Kim, which he had in his left breast pocket, had stopped a bullet. Hamanu presented Kipling with the book, with the bullet still embedded in it, and his Croix de Guerre as a token of gratitude. They continued to correspond, and when Hamanu had a son, Kipling insisted on returning the book and the medal to him. So, I mean, that's very sad there, isn't it? I mean, he must have felt so guilty about that. It's as if life was saying, look, your son is not for the army. He gets rejected twice, and then Kipling goes in there, and as a favour to him, they take his son on. And then his son dies. And the reason why he was rejected was because of his eyesight. And as it says here, the last they can recall of him is him stumbling around blindly. I mean, he must have lost his spectacles at the time. I mean, he must have felt so guilty. after that. I think that line there, if any question why we died, tell them because our fathers lied. I think that's got to be referring to himself, hasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. That would seem to be the very sad conclusion that we must draw from this. It's and again, as far as the enlistment is concerned, although it's not exactly analogous to blind obedience as far as the army is concerned, there was to a great extent there was blind acceptance that the government told the truth in those days, because that tended to be the case in many in most instances, and the early part of the 20th century was the period where politicians started to become corrupted and started to stop looking out for the British people as a nation, and stopped regarding our ethnic interests as being the highest cause that we can work towards, and started to think of other things and to hold other things as a more cherished aim than this nation's ethnic interests. And so when people were told to enlist, they tended to enlist, and those people that didn't enlist were regarded as cowards, and we had these sort of conscientious objectors being given white feathers in the street by young women, etc., to shame them into enlisting and going off to fight. And of course the First World War was a very dysgenic process during which the best of an entire generation were sent off to be slaughtered, effectively, which is incredibly sad. And it's something that we have struggled as a nation to recover from even to this day.
I think we should also highlight this bit here where the guy was actually saved by the book Kim, which he had in his left breast pocket. I mean, that's the sort of thing you see happening in the movies, isn't it? You don't think it actually really did happen, but it really did happen. And it was Rudyard Kipling's book that actually saved his life.
Actually happened to my grandfather as well. He was hit with a shell that exploded in front of him, and a piece of shrapnel lodged in his army paybook that was in his breast pocket of his tunic, and that saved him from the shrapnel penetrating too far into his chest. He lost a leg at the same time, was saved it with a similar sort of means.
Not quite as romantic as a book of Kim. It was his paycheck, paycheck or paybook, or whatever it was. Well, partly in response to his son's death, Kipling joins Sir Fabian Ware's Imperial War Graves Commission, a group responsible for the garden-like British war graves that can be found to this day dotted along the former Western Front and the other places in the world where British Empire troops lie buried. His main contributions to the project were his selection of the biblical phrase, "Their name liveth forevermore," which is Ecclesiasticus 44:14 from the King James Version, found on the stones of remembrance in larger war cemeteries, and his suggestion of the phrase, "known unto God," for the gravestones of unidentified servicemen. He also chose the inscription, "The Glorious Dead," on the Cenotaph, Whitehall, London. Additionally, he wrote a two-volume history of the Irish Guards, his son's regiment, published in 1923 and seen as one of the finest examples ever written of regimental history. Kipling's short story, The Gardener, depicts visits to the war cemeteries, and his poem, The King's Pilgrimage, 1922, depicts a journey which King George V made, touring the cemeteries and memorials under construction by the Imperial War Graves Commission. And you were pointing something out about the Imperial War Graves Commission, I think, in one of these other episodes that we did, Max, about the fact that it's only white people that do this, that actually honour our dead that fought in these wars. And what they're trying to say now is they're trying to say that we were racist for not also including blacks and native Indians in these war graves. But what they said at the time was that they wouldn't have understood it. They didn't actually have that sort of a tradition, so why would we include them as well? It's a very noble Noble Endeavour, I think, this Imperial War Graves Commission, and Rudyard Kipling obviously played quite a prominent role in it. If he was coming up with the phrases that were actually used and the quotes that were actually used, do you want to comment on that, Max?
Oh, just that yes, the we did talk about this before, and there are large parts of the Third World where there are no graveyards, or there are no graveyards that predate white people going to those places. Because the concept of burying your dead was just something that didn't really occur to people, and certainly burying them with any kind of memorial or monument to them was something that just hadn't actually occurred to the peoples that lived in those lands prior to when they were colonized. And so as far as and particularly as far as the British Army is concerned, the British Army have striven, and particularly so following the First World War, striven to make sure that there are that everybody that gave their life for this country was provided with a the very best memorial possible in terms of a grave, and if a grave couldn't be provided, that their name would be recorded on a war memorial.
Well, maybe it probably did actually help with an idea of a continuation of history from one generation to another. I mean, you hear of a lot of these natives, and they don't really have the concept of there being anything before they were alive. They just take everything from day to day. And yet, if you've got memorials to the dead that go back centuries or thousands of years, it helps you to have an understanding in the progression of history, which I think is another thing which is unique to whites. Well, as a Francophile, Kipling argued strongly for an Anglo-French alliance to uphold the peace after the war, calling Britain and France in 1920 the twin fortresses of European civilization. An admirer of Raymond Poincaré, Kipling was one of few British intellectuals who supported the French occupation of the Ruhr in 1923, at a time when the British government and most public opinion was against the French position. In contrast to the popular British view of Poincaré as a cruel bully intent on impoverishing Germany with unreasonable reparations, Kipling argued that he was rightfully trying to preserve France as a great power in the face of an unfavourable situation. Kipling argued that even before 1914, Germany's larger economy and higher birth rate had made that country stronger than France, and with much of France devastated by war and the French suffering heavy losses, meant that its low birth rate would give it trouble, while Germany was mostly undamaged and still had a higher birth rate. So he reasoned that the future would bring German domination if Versailles were revised in Germany's favour, and he thought it was madness for Britain to press France to do so. I think that's the first time that I've actually read an argument in favour of France there. Most of the reports that we look at say that the Versailles Treaty pretty much guaranteed that there was going to be a Second World War. So obviously Kipling here felt more of an alliance towards his French brethren rather than the Germans. Have you got any thoughts on that, Max?
No, not I can think of that of any great import, no.
well, you would think that because Kipling was against the Versailles Treaty, he might have been against fascism, but I don't think he was. In 1924, Kipling was opposed to the Labour government of Ramsay MacDonald as Bolshevism without bullets. He believed that Labour was a communist front organisation and that excited orders and instructions from Moscow would expose Labour as such to the British people. Kipling's views were certainly on the right. Though he admired Benito Mussolini to some extent in the 1920s, he was against fascism, saying Oswald Mosley was a bounder and an avarifste. In 1935, he was calling Mussolini a deranged and dangerous egomaniac, and in 1933 he wrote, "The Hitlerites are out for blood." And of course, again, this will be because of the propaganda that he saw. Despite his anti-communist views, the first major translations of Kipling into Russian took place under Lenin's rule in the early 1920s, and Kipling was popular with Russian readers in the interwar period, and many younger Russian poets and writers such as Konstantin Simonov were influenced by him. Kipling's clarity of style, use of colloquial language, and employment of rhythm and rhyme were seen as major innovations in poetry that appealed to many younger Russian poets. Although it was obligatory for Soviet journals to begin translations of Kipling with an attack on him as a fascist and an imperialist, such was Kipling's popularity with Russian readers that his works were not banned in the Soviet Union until 1939 with the signing of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. The ban was lifted in 1941 after Operation Barbarossa began, when Britain became a Soviet ally, but was imposed again for good with the Cold War in 1946. So the communists thought that he was a fascist, and I would suggest that his views were certainly sort of fascist-type, nationalist-type views, although he was against Mussolini and Hitler. But again, I think that would have been because of the propaganda. And then we come to the swastika. Many older editions of Kipling's books have a swastika printed on the cover, along with a picture of an elephant carrying a lotus flower, reflecting the influence of Indian culture. Kipling's use of the swastika was based on the Indian sun symbol conferring good luck and the Sanskrit word meaning fortunate or well-being. He used the symbol in both its right and its left-facing forms, and it was in general use by others at the time too. In a note to Edward Bok after the death of Lockwood Kipling in 1911, Rudyard said, "I am sending with this for your acceptance as some little memory of my father, to whom you were so kind, the original of one of the plaques that he used to make for me. I thought, it being the swastika, it would be appropriate for your swastika. May it bring you even more good fortune." And the Kipling Journal itself used a frame of black swastikas on its red cover until issue number 36, which was published in December 1935. So we have the signs of National Socialism there, really, and certainly he's nationalist-minded, but publicly he sort of distances himself from this. And the swastika was in use by a lot of people at the time. I mean, it was a positive symbol intended to bring people good fortune. And I think it had been in use by the National Socialists for about 15 years by that point, by 1935. I think they came up with it in 1920 as something that would grab the attention of the public and be an opposite sort of symbol to the communist hammer and the sickle. That's why they chose the red and the white. And obviously because it was a symbol of Aryans, basically, and again, this is why Kipling is using it, because he's seen it used in India for good luck, and that's where it came from, is from the Aryans. Wherever the Aryans have been in the world, you will find the swastika. Have you got any thoughts on any of that, Max?
Well, just that Kipling again lived through a period which was again another tipping point, and this is a tipping point between the patriotism that European peoples felt still being based around a narrower form of nationalism than people would tend to adopt today. I think nowadays people recognize that whilst they may feel a form of patriotism for, you know, for England, for example, that they will also have a broader sense of patriotism for Britain and the peoples of the British Isles, and will then also have a broader sense of patriotism for the other peoples of European extraction. And I think that whilst we've included Kipling in our Greatest Britain series, just because we have doesn't mean to say that everything he did or thought was right. His writing was very engaging writing, and means that he quite justifiably holds a position within our list of Greatest Britons. But I think in respect to his attitudes towards other European countries, his patriotism and his nationalism was too narrowly focused, which meant that he saw France as an ally. He saw Germany as an enemy. When in reality he should have seen both as an ally, in terms of cementing the dominant position that European countries had in the world at the time. And if that, you know, where people of his generation are to be criticized, it is in the fact that they believed that, or that they didn't realize that in order for European civilization to become something that is eternal, it is necessary for us to have a dominant influence across the globe, and in that we were on the verge of establishing that dominant influence as a permanent thing, we should have had a broader framework for our sense of nationalism than just the immediate nation to which we belonged, and that we should have realized that we had to work together with other European nations in establishing that primacy in the world if it was to endure. I'm not saying that it's beyond the possibility that we can return to those heady days, but we've certainly given ourselves an uphill task now, and to some extent that is down to the kind of attitude that Kipling still demonstrated, but which hopefully is being replaced by a more broader racially based sense of nationalism.
I guess we could call it petty nationalism or jingoism. And the problem is, you know, we tend to forget that it wasn't really until the advent of National Socialism that there was this idea of the broader white peoples. And even then, there were some aspects of National Socialism which tended to see Southern Europeans and Slavics as somehow being different to the Nordics. I mean, we didn't really get this, you know, this grasp of it. We are competing as white people against all these other races until after World War II. And what we're talking about here is the period in between World War I and World War II. And instead of seeing these other races as our competitors, Kipling was still seeing the other Europeans as our competitors. Well, Kipling kept writing until the early 1930s, but at a much slower pace and with less success than before. And on the night of the 12th of January 1936, he suffered a hemorrhage in his small intestine. He underwent surgery but died at Middlesex Hospital less than a week later, on the 18th of January 1936, at the age of 70, of a perforated duodenal ulcer. His death had previously been incorrectly announced in a magazine, to which he wrote, "I have just read that I am dead. Don't forget to delete me from your list of subscribers." The pallbearers at the funeral included Kipling's cousin, Prime Minister Stanley Baldwin, and the marble casket was covered by a Union Jack. He was cremated at Golders Green Crematorium in northwest London, and his ashes interred at Poets' Corner, part of the south transept of Westminster Abbey, next to the graves of Charles Dickens and Thomas Hardy. Interesting that he was cremated at Golders Green. There's no other mention of any Jewish links that I've managed to find, and perhaps Golders Green wasn't so associated with Jews back then, 100 years ago, as it is now. Do you know anything about that, Max?
I should think that the main Jewish population in Britain, or certainly in London, would have been around the East End of London, and it would only be later in the sort of 30s and 40s that there would have been a migration, perhaps even later than that, perhaps post-Second World War, there would have been a migration of Jews from there to North London.
Right, well, that answers that bit then. In 2010, the International Astronomical Union approved the naming of a crater on the planet Mercury after Kipling, one of 10 newly discovered impact craters observed by the Messenger spacecraft in 2008-2009. And in 2012, an extinct species of crocodile, the Gonopholis kiplingi, was named in his honour, in recognition for his enthusiasm for natural sciences. His children's stories remain popular, and his jungle books have been made into several films. Other films have been produced by the Walt Disney Company. A number of his poems were set to music by Percy Grainger, and a series of short films based on some of his stories was broadcast by the BBC in 1964. Kipling's work is still very popular today, and as I've mentioned earlier in the series, I used to really enjoy reading the Just So stories in particular by Kipling. The poet T.S. Eliot edited A Choice of Kipling's Verse, 1941, with an introductory essay, and aware of the complaints that have been levelled against Kipling, he dismissed them all, one by one. that Kipling is a Tory using his verse to transmit right-wing political views, or a journalist pandering to popular taste. While Eliot writes, I cannot find any justification for the charge that he held a doctrine of race superiority. Eliot finds instead an immense gift for using words, an amazing curiosity and power of observation with his mind and with all his senses. The mask of the entertainer, and beyond that, a queer gift of second sight, of transmitting messages from elsewhere, a gift so disconcerting when we are made aware of it that thenceforth we are never sure when it is not present. All this makes Kipling a writer impossible wholly to understand and quite impossible to belittle. On Kipling's verse, such as his barrack room ballads, Eliot writes, of a number of poets who have written great poetry, only a very few whom I should call great verse writers, and unless I am mistaken, Kipling's position in this class is not only high, but unique. In response to Eliot, George Orwell wrote a long consideration of Kipling's work for Horizon in 1942, noting that although as a jingo imperialist, Kipling was morally insensitive and aesthetically disgusting. His work had many qualities which ensured that while every enlightened person had despised him, 9/10 of those enlightened persons are forgotten and Kipling is in some sense still there. And George Orwell has this to say about Rudyard Kipling. One reason for Kipling's power was his sense of responsibility, which made it possible for him to have a world view, even though it happened to be a false one. Although he had no direct connection with any political party, Kipling was a conservative, a thing that does not exist nowadays. Those who now call themselves conservatives are either liberals, fascists, or the accomplices of fascists. He identified himself with the ruling power and not with the opposition. In a gifted writer, this seems to us strange and even disgusting, but it did have the advantage of giving Kipling a certain grip on reality. The ruling power is always faced with the question, in such and such circumstances, what would you do? Whereas the opposition is not obliged to take responsibility or make any real decisions. Where it is a permanent and pensioned opposition, as in England, the quality of its thought deteriorates accordingly. Moreover, anyone who starts out with a pessimistic reactionary view of life tends to be justified by events, for utopia never arrives, and the gods of the copybook headings, as Kipling himself put it, always return. Kipling sold out to the British governing class, not financially, but emotionally. This warped his political judgment, for the British ruling class were not what he imagined, and it led him into abysses of folly and snobbery. But he gained a corresponding advantage from having at least tried to imagine what action and responsibility are like. It is a great thing in his favour that he is not witty nor daring, but has no wish to épater les bourgeois. He dealt largely in platitudes, and since we live in a world of platitudes, much of what he said sticks. Even his worst follies seem less shallow and less irritating than the enlightened utterances of the same period, such as Wilde's epigrams or the collection of cracker mottos at the end of Man and Superman. And that was George Orwell. So he obviously some sour grapes there between George Orwell.
Yeah, that's Kipling. Right. But I suppose that's what you would expect, really, that to some extent it may just be an entirely different point of view. To some extent, it may be professional jealousy, because the two men would have been, to some extent, rivals, wouldn't they, during the same period. And so there would have been some ill feeling as a result of that.
I think George Orwell supported the communists as well, didn't he? And the Spanish War, he was on the side of the communists, the anarchists in the Spanish Civil War, I seem to remember, even though he wrote 1984.
I'm not quite sure about that. I can't remember, no, but it's quite possible, certainly. I think that there would have been a degree of political opposition and a degree of jealousy. I think, as far as Orwell was concerned, he wasn't a nationalist, and was probably more left wing than Kipling would have been. And And again, he was a probably a more complex character than some people would want us to assume, because again, he lived during this tipping point in the early part of the 20th century, where, you know, a lot of things changed, and I think a lot of opinions changed, and a lot of people who perhaps set out thinking of themselves as socialists eventually became something other than socialist, perhaps more liberal or perhaps more conservative. And a lot of people that started off as conservatives changed their opinion and became perhaps more socialistically inclined. And so I think a lot of the characters that lived during the early 20th century were a lot more complex than you might ostensibly assume.
I think the where you're saying there that the conservatives, some of them are fascists, I think maybe that's referring to Neville Chamberlain when he came back with Peace in Our Time from Adolf Hitler, because there was a lot of criticism for that at the time. So you can see T.S. Eliot was very enamoured by him and praised him, but George Orwell wasn't so pleased with him. Well, in modern-day India, whence he drew most of his material, Kipling's reputation remains controversial, especially among modern nationalists and some post-colonial critics. Rudyard Kipling was a prominent supporter of Colonel Reginald Dyer, who was responsible for the Jallianwala Bagh massacre in Amritsar in the province of Punjab. Kipling called Dyer the man who saved India, and initiated collections for the latter's homecoming prize. However, Suvash Chopra writes in his book Kipling Sahib, The Raj Patriot, that the benefit fund was started by the Morning Post newspaper and not by Kipling, and that Kipling made no contribution to the Dyer Fund. While Kipling's name was conspicuously absent from the list of donors as published in the Morning Post, he clearly admired Dyer. Other contemporary Indian intellectuals, such as Ashish Nandi, have taken a more nuanced view. Jawaharlal Nehru, the first Prime Minister of independent India, often described Kipling's novel Kim as one of his favourite books. Indian writer Kushwant Singh wrote in 2001 that he considers Kipling's If to be the essence of the message of the Gita in English, referring to the Bhagavad Gita, an ancient Indian scripture. And in November 2007, it was announced that Kipling's birth home in the campus of the JJ School of Art in Mumbai would be turned into a museum celebrating the author and his works. So his works are still living on over 100 years later, and the Indians are still quite pleased with him, I think. We didn't learn much about his support for Colonel Reginald Dyer as we went through this story, but I think we've talked about him before at some point in the series. And I thought this was the first author that we'd actually done, but we also did the author of The History of the Kings of Britain, didn't we? Although that's more a factual book,
yes,
than this one. But he's certainly a great man and a great a great patriot and a credit to the British people. You know, when we think of all the achievements he had and all the credit that was paid to him, winning the Nobel Prize for Literature and learning that English was thought of as one of the best languages to be written in, and he was the poet of the empire, and set a good example most of the time. I mean, the only critique you can really make is when he was making that wartime propaganda. But of course, you know, also you've got to think, well, his loyalty's got to be to his country, and he wants his country to win. It's like when Oswald Mosley, when they locked him up in prison, he said, well, you know, we may be against the war, but if we have to go and fight, we are fighting to win for Britain. You don't need to lock us up. So really, I think, you know, what would you do? You would say, well, I'm against the war, but if you had to fight for your country, you had to fight for your country. And so he was really doing his best for Britain, because Britain was at war against Germany, and he would have fallen for that propaganda as well. He quite clearly believed in all of it, and he paid dearly for it as well, losing his son, I think.
Yes.
Well, shall we leave that there then today, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming on today.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you, and of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.